Well, hello, listeners. Here's another episode of Islam in Focus with your show host, Andrew Arid. This is a weekly occurring blog talk radio show where we examine the role in Islam in the world, both for Muslims and non-Muslims. And today we would like to look at the issue of historical memory, the West and Islam. Of course, as all of you, I'm sure, are aware with the news, we since the May 25th, 2020, police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a black man. This has unleashed a storm of iconoclasm, as it were, across the world against anything and everything associated with racism or genocide, whether real or imagined. We'll discuss that in any of the particular issues. For example, once again, the issue of Confederate monuments and references to the Confederacy in the United States have come to the fore. Virginia government has recently, the governor of Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam, of blackface Ku Klux Klan fame, infamy, has ordered that the Robert E. Lee statue, as well as the other statues on Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, the capital of Virginia, honoring various Confederate leaders. There's a statue there of Robert E. Lee, as well as Jeb Stuart is on Monument Avenue. Robert E. Lee was, of course, the commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, the one of the leading fighting forces of the Confederacy in Virginia, under the Confederacy's most renowned commander, Robert E. Lee, as well as there's a statue of Jeb Stuart, one of his famous cavalry commanders, and there's a statue of Jefferson Davis, the president of this secessionist slaveholding Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. There, this, of course, follows on with other controversies of Lee and other statues in Charlottesville, Virginia, where there's a Lee statue as well as another Stonewall Jackson statue about three blocks next to each, near each other, one in Lee Park, the Lee statue, and the Stonewall Jackson statue is near the town courthouse, old courthouse. There's also then increased criticism of military installations and buildings at the military academies named after people with Confederate affiliations. The American military has been listed 10 such bases with Confederate names. These are all in the south of the country, formed during times, for example, during World War I and World War II, and the naming process was influenced by the local sentiment of these states. Like Fort Hood in Texas is named after John Bell Hood, a Kentuckian who led the noted, well-known Texas Brigade in the Army of Northern Virginia under Robert E. Lee. And Fort Bragg in North Carolina is named after Braxton Bragg, a Confederate general who, for example, led the Confederate Army at the battles of Chickamauga and Chattanooga. He had also been a famous Mexican War veteran, noted for the phrase by his commanding officer, Zachary Taylor, had once said at the Battle of Buena Vista in 1847, a little more grape shot, Mr. Bragg. And then Fort Benning in Georgia, named after Henry Toombs Benning. He commanded a Georgia brigade, particularly, for example, at Antietam, at the famous stone bridge there that was taken by General Burnside's 9th Corps, the bloody fight to take the stone bridge at Antietam. He was a notable advocate of slavery and secession before the Civil War. And, of course, then another in Virginia near Petersburg, there's a Fort Lee named after Robert E. Lee. There's also a military base more in the northern part of the state named after A.P. Hill. The Fort Rucker in Alabama is named after Edmund Rucker, another Confederate. So that now there's increased calls for these names to be changed, named after officers who broke their oath to the American Union, as they're condemned for in this Civil War, in the name of this slave-holding society. Many of them personally also own some slaves, is of course the argument. They're also at the military academies, at Annapolis Naval Academy, and at West Point. There are various things named after, for example, at West Point, of course, Robert E. Lee, where he had he was a superintendent of West Point before the Civil War, and had an intimate relationship with the military academy from which he graduated. And at Annapolis, there are various buildings named after, for example, Maury, the famed Pathfinder of the Seas, a oceanographer who later supported the Confederacy, and also the first superintendent of the Naval Academy was Franklin Buchanan. He later fought for the Confederacy. If I recall correctly, he commanded the ironclad Alabama at the Naval Battle of Mobile Bay in 1864, August 5th, 1864, where Admiral Farragut, whose statue is in Farragut Square in Washington, D.C., and was also among all of these latest riots and looting, his statue was vandalized with graffiti, even though he was a famed Union admiral, famous for saying, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead," when trying to enter the harbor of Mobile Bay, past Confederate forts guarding it, and going through a Confederate minefield, or torpedoes as they were called at the time, which sank one of his ironclads as his Union fleet was trying to run the Confederate defenses and get into Mobile Bay, whereupon they Farragut's ships, in particular his flagship, the USS Hartford, had a battle with the ironclad Alabama under the command of Franklin Buchanan. And so there's a building named for him at Annapolis that people suggested his name should be changed. Also here in the Washington, D.C. area where I live, on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., there are various statues in the Capitol building placed there by the various state governments, and the various southern states have placed statues there, four figures associated with the Confederacy, one from Virginia for Robert E. Lee again. There's also Alexander Stevens has a statue from Georgia. He was vice president of the Confederacy and is noted for his really sort of infamous cornerstone speech right when in 1860, late 1860, when the Confederate states were seceding, where he stated that this Confederate government, this new Confederacy, would be the first government in the world actually founded upon the supremacy of whites over blacks, and that the idea of any sort of human equality as proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence was wrong. That was simply a fault. So with this whole movement set off by the death of George Floyd and this resurgence again of the Black Lives Matter movement and the slogan Black Lives Matter, there's been once again an all-out soul-searching of racism in American history and also Western history. This movement has extended in all sorts of I had an interruption, technical difficulty. But in Belgium as well, there are all of these statues and place names for King Leopold II all over Belgium, and there's been various defacement of these statues. King Leopold II was the second monarch of Belgium, formed in 1830, and later led what is called often been called the only private colony in the world when he established in 1885, the Congo Free State. And he ruled that as his own personal colony, under his own direct rule, not under Belgium, until 1908. And it's estimated that under his rule, the population of this Congo Free State, this Belgian Congo, fell from some 20 million to 10 million. He had such brutal practices of forcing the natives to work for rubber, find rubber, which had become newly valuable for tires, for bicycles and things, also the ivory trade was something he promoted, and he would do things like hold women hostage in order to force their men to go engage in these exploitation activities. There were then rebellions, and the one tactic that King Leopold the II had was his troops in his own private army were told to hack off hands of for every bullet they shot to kill a person as proof that someone had been killed. And so if someone, say, missed with a bullet, they would then just go find someone and hack off their hands. And so you have this collection of all these hands. So there was also then, through all of these practices, there was a tremendous drop in birth rates and starvation. So the population dropped from, it's estimated, from 20 million to about 10 million. So he's condemned as such a brutal, indeed, ruler, indeed, promoter of genocide. So his statues are under attack. Also in Bristol, England, a former slave port in England, the statue of Edward Colston has been thrown into the Bristol River there, taken off. He was a noted slaver. He was a leader in the Royal African Company, a slave trading company founded in 1672, and he oversaw the transport of some over 83,000 slaves from Africa to the North American colonies, and it's estimated almost a quarter of them, some 19,000 of them, died along the way. He had a statue put up because he was a great philanthropist in Bristol, England, and had donated to all sorts of charities, but of course his great wealth came from enslaving and working people to death. And so there's been campaigns to remove his statue, and finally a mob just came in and ripped it down, toppled it over, and threw it into the Bristol River just a couple of days ago. Then as well, beyond the Confederacy and imperialists and slavers, Christopher Columbus in the United States is coming under attack again. A statue of his in Richmond, Virginia was thrown into a pond, I believe, or a lake. Another statue of his in Minneapolis in Minnesota, or rather St. Paul, Minnesota, in front of the state capitol, where I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, was simply also, like the Edward Colston statue, simply ripped down, pulled off its mount, its plinth. And in Boston, Massachusetts, a Christopher Columbus statue up in the North End neighborhood of Boston, a historic Italian neighborhood of North End, was beheaded. These are all attacks on Christopher Columbus because supposedly he was just an evil originator of slavery and genocide in the New World. Groups like the Knights of Columbus, this Catholic fraternal lay organization founded in 1882 in the United States and takes its name precisely from Christopher Columbus. It was the organization that worked to get Christopher Columbus Day, marking his landing in the Bahamas on October 12, 1492, as as Christopher Columbus Day holiday in the United States, has protested this defamation of Christopher Columbus. There's a lot of myth-making propaganda about Christopher Columbus, about how he was just unredeemably evil. He was his actual character towards the Native Americans in the New World was far more complex. I mean, he's perhaps a man of his time who thought that these Native Americans should be subjugated under Spanish rule, but he was not someone who was inherently evil-minded towards Native Americans. I mean, he for example, adopted a Native American son and told his men to be kind to the Native Americans in their dealings with them and their trading with them and so forth. These issues as well call to mind, for me at least, similar controversies that have existed in Germany dealing with their past under the Third Reich, in particular in World War II and the Nazis, as well as previously under other regimes like the Kaiserreich in World War I. They've had to deal with issues of military installations and ships being named after people in particular who were notable figures in World War II, for example, until I believe about a decade and a half ago, The German mountain troops had their barracks, their base, near the border with Austria and the Alps, and it was named the Dietl Kaserne or Dietl Barracks, named after a famed a German general during World War II, who commanded German mountain troops during World War II in Norway and Finland. He was a skilled commander, but he was also a really fervent Nazi who abused, for example, Soviet prisoners under his in his control, under his command. That name was then ultimately changed. There had been much controversy about him during the 1990s. When I was in Germany, for example, there's also a Rommel Barracks in southern Germany named, of course, after the famed Desert Fox, Erwin Rommel. He is someone that, as an individual, the Germany and the German military in particular are more willing to accept. He was a famed general, skillful soldier, and someone who is not really associated with war crimes, did not particularly support any such war crimes, fighting in the desert or elsewhere, and even had a sort of tangential relationship later to the plot to kill Hitler in July 20th, 1944, and such that Hitler ordered his execution. He had to commit suicide by cyanide poisoning. So there's a barracks named after him. Also, the first some of the first ships of the German Navy after World War II, four Sherman-class destroyers given to Germany by bought from the United States by Germany were named. One was named Rommel. Another was named Mulders after a leading German fighter pilot and air power theoretician, fighter commander during World War II in the German Luftwaffe. And another was named Lütjen, which was, rather Lütjens, which was much more problematic. He was the commander of the battleship Bismarck when it was on its run out into the Atlantic in May of 1941 and finally was sunk by the British. And he was also much more of a devoted follower of Adolf Hitler. But now this problem in the German Navy no longer exists because they don't name their ships anymore from any individuals with any such German past. Ships in the German Navy today merely have geographic names like German provinces, Brandenburg, or German cities, Hamburg, and so forth. So this issue no longer exists. The American military as well, recent legislation has passed that the military will no longer name anything after make any further Confederate names. For example, in the past, there's been after World War II, there was a nuclear attack submarine named the Robert E. Lee. That will never again happen. It's now prohibited to name anything with any future Confederate reference. Well, this is all, I guess, something we in the societies like the United States and the West, we're familiar with this. This is part and parcel of Western society, that you engage in self-criticism, you reflect on things. We live in democratic societies. We try to improve things, make things better. We have trial and error processes. We test things. We examine them in all fields, in politics and science and economics, in literature, art, and history. You can say that this is, of course, is very spiritually oriented, very biblical. In the faith tradition of the West, of Christianity, that as sinners, in Judeo-Christian scriptures, as sinners, we're all supposed to reflect on what sins we've done. This is clear throughout the Jewish and Christian scriptures in the Bible. So it's all really rather normal and perfectly acceptable for the West to continue to critically examine its society, its history, and to learn from these past mistakes and evils. This, however, raises a question precisely that so many leftists and, for that matter, Islamist forces are often leading these movements with the Black Lives Movement. As I, for example, written at Jihad Watch, you have a kind of rainbow coalition, or as it's called, a red-green coalition, supporting movements like Black Lives Matters. For example, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, this Hamas-derived Muslim Brotherhood group in the United States that likes to present itself as a great advocate for civil rights, they as well have come out with a public policy position that all of these Confederate statues should be taken down, all of these references in public places to the Confederacy should be erased. This is actually not opinion that, according to survey data, most people want. I mean, I think in principle, most people like me would argue that, for example, such statues in public places like in Richmond, Virginia, should stay as historical monuments that remind us of our past and of the issues involved in the past of slavery and secession and the Confederacy. We don't have to revere them. We can have a different, a more critical approach to them, but it's better to leave them up in public places and to examine their history rather than just simply rip them down. But CARE has come out and said that they want the all such statues ripped down, and yet it seems ironic or hypocritical, given that the legacy of Islam also involves similar evils like slavery and jihad aggression. So upon what position does CARE call for the removal of such statues? For example, John Zemirik, whom I've had on this program before, a Catholic writer, has tweeted out on this issue that, you know, why shouldn't mosques be ripped down? That, of course, revere Muhammad as a prophet. I mean, it's a facetious sort of comment of his, rhetorical comment. Douglas Murray, the British atheist, has also tweeted out on this issue, asking people to guess which religion had a slave-holding founder, namely Muhammad in Islam. So this raises the question, why is there so much, why does this criticism, this self-reflection in the West not raise any questions then about Islam, which actually is far more disturbing than what might be suggested by the phrase religion of peace. For example, Islamic battles are still, in Islamic military history, is still very much a source of pride throughout Muslim-majority societies. For example, the Palestinian Liberation Organization had a Yarmouk Brigade, which was named after the Battle of the Yarmouk from 636, one of the early battles of the Islamic expansion following Muhammad's death in 632, where the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, was decisively defeated at the Yarmouk River, and in what is now, if I recall, modern Jordan or modern Syria. And this defeat then opened up the Levant to Islamic conquest from the Islamic armies coming out of the Arabian Peninsula. Jerusalem fell, and then later Egypt fell. Saddam Hussein as well had in his Republican Guard, one of his divisions was named the Qadisiyya Division, after the Qadisiyya Battle, which happened in 637, shortly after the Battle of Yarmouk. Here, Muslim armies defeated the Persians, the Zoroastrian Persians, and then opened up Iran and Iraq for Islamic conquest. And so Saddam Hussein had a particular interest in focusing on this battle because he liked to present himself as an Arab warrior, Arab Muslim warrior against the hated Iranian enemy, Iraq's neighbors. As discussed on this program recently with the historian Raymond Ibrahim, the fall of Constantinople on May 29, 1453 is now annually celebrated in Turkey. Under its Islamist leader, Recep Erdogan, they have massive military parades and people in period costumes celebrating this really bloody sack of the capital of the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, the last remnant of this empire, which then fell with its loss of its capital, and many of the inhabitants of the city of Constantinople, some 50,000, were taken into slavery, and there were various rapes throughout the city as the city was sacked. So it's very strange that the United States and Germany and other countries would really reflect upon their military history and question just exactly what military traditions they would have. But apparently in Muslim-majority societies, these battles and these conquests are just something to take pride in. There's no criticism of someone like, say, the victor at the Battle of Qadisiyah, Khalid ibn al-Walid, who's often called the Sword of Islam, whom Raymond Ibrahim, in his excellent book recently discussed on this show, A Sword and Scimitar, is known. It was really, according to Islamic accounts, he was really a psychopath. In particular, he once cooked his dinner over the head of a beheaded opponent he had killed during the Wars of the Ridda, or Apostasy Wars, following Muhammad's death from 632 to 634, when various Arab tribes in the Arab Peninsula tried to renounce their allegiance to Muhammad and Islam upon his death. But this apparently doesn't raise any questions in Muslim majority societies, unlike, say, Confederates like Robert E. Lee or John Bell Hood here in the United States, or Dietl in Germany. Islamic slavery was part and parcel of these jihadist conquests, as, for example, the Ghana scholar John Azuma has studied in his book on the legacy of Arab Islam in Africa. Such scholars have noted that Islamic slavery was perhaps even greater in extent than the transatlantic slave trade from Africa to the New World, to the Americas, to North American colonies, the Caribbean, and South America. There are perhaps some 12 million Africans taken to the New World under the transatlantic slave trade, whereas perhaps some 17 million Africans were taken out of Africa in the Muslim slave trade across centuries. There's also, Europeans were taken from Europe into slavery by Muslims from North Africa. Some estimates suggest perhaps 1.25 million Europeans were taken by Muslim slavers into slavery from as far away as Iceland during a slave raid in 1627. Such slave raids devastated the Mediterranean, France and Italy. Spain really set back this region. We, of course, had our own involvement with such Muslim slavers and pirates, with the Barbary Pirates, one of America's first wars as an independent nation, the founding of the American Navy in 1797, and then later employed under Thomas Jefferson to subdue the Barbary Pirates, and from which the Marine Corps hymn gets its famous line, "From the to the sands of Tripoli," given the Marine involvement in the Barbary Pirate Wars. This Islamic slavery was really not any more benign than slavery in the New World. Islamic slavery, for example, often involved castration of men who were then taken as eunuchs to be guards of harems for Islamic rulers with all these women. Most of these men actually did not survive such castration without any modern medicine or anesthesia. Azuma has noted that Islamic slavery, in contrast to the transatlantic slave trade, was more sexual in nature. Slaves were mostly taken into the New World as plantation workers, whereas the focus on Islamic slavery often was on having women sex slaves. And to that extent, there's not therefore, within Arab societies, there's not much of any legacy of slavery in such societies, as opposed to the New World, where you have large African diaspora, because these women, the offspring of these women were black offspring of these women. They were offspring of their Arab masters. Now, Islamic doctrine does not necessarily, in principle, you could say, does not distinguish between ethnicities. I guess in the same way you could say that the Bible, Christianity, does not distinguish between ethnicities, or for that matter, communism does not distinguish between ethnicities. Although in practice, of course, just as Christians in the New World have been racist, communists like Che Guevara in Cuba can be racist. And the Quran in verses such as Surah 3, Ayah 69, and Surah 3, Ayah verse 106, do indeed contain references to what could be called, what has been called colorism. That is, that the color black always has negative associations. This also occurs in various hadith, where, for example, Muhammad singles out the killing of black dogs. And also various Islamic scholars have consistently associated black with negative associations, and therefore consistently condemned blacks. For example, Al-Tabari, a Muslim interpreter of the Quran who died in 923, was very derogatory towards Africans, towards blacks, as well as the famed Muslim historian Ibn Khaldun, who died in 1406. All of these individuals had all sorts, were very derogatory towards blacks. So there really is significant racism against blacks in many Muslim societies, and particularly Arab societies, which continues to this day. For example, many Arabs have noted that the word for blacks in the Arab language has come to be the word for slave, Abd, precisely because all of these blacks historically have been enslaved from Africa by Muslim Arabs. You can make parallels with, for example, the theological racism that existed in the Church of Latter-day Saints, that the references in the Book of Mormon, that there was once this battle and God turned the evil loser tribes of this battle, he turned their skin color black. And because of such theories, until supposedly there was a revelation in Ghana in 1977, saying that blacks could also fully participate in the Church of Latter-day Saints. Up until that time, the Mormons did not allow blacks to become church leaders. They could merely become members, but not leaders. So you could perhaps maybe make a parallel there. This directly contradicts a lot of propaganda from one particular individual, namely Craig Considine, who is a professor of sociology at Rice University and seems to have made his life work into being a constant sort of apologist and propagandist for Islam. He's sort of like the next Karen Armstrong, someone who has no particular background in issues of Islam. Karen Armstrong was just a former nun and graduate of Oxford University, but had no particular studies in Islamic theology and so forth. Such individuals have gone on to have famed careers as being supposed experts on Islam, who pronounce that everything in Islam is just really wonderful, and Islam's prophet Muhammad really should have gotten a Nobel Peace Prize, just like Barack Obama, if only such a peace prize had existed in the in 7th century Arabia. They seem to just constantly find new wondrous things that Islam advocates. If you follow his Twitter account and follow him online, you'll see that he's consistently promoted Islam as an anti-racist faith, particularly today. The message he seems to be giving out is that if we want to deal with any and all racist traumas that we have in the United States or elsewhere, course, there's a question of just how racist is America today in the 21st century following the, for example, the election of Barack Obama to the presidency. You always hear this cry of systematic racism, but as conservative black commentators like Shelby Steele will tell you that they just don't find racism today to be a sort of significant societal factor. It's more like, say, anti-Semitism or something. It's, I mean, prejudice can exist, but to say that the problems of black individuals in the United States are fundamentally due to racism is false. I mean, he will tell you that he grew up in a segregated America that truly was a racist society for Shelby Steele and other black Americans. But Craig Consendini has been promoting Islam as so far as sort of this ideological cure for racism. He's used in his videos online the example of Bilal, Islam's first muezzin under Muhammad. That is the person who makes the call to prayer from the mosque. However, if you look at this video, it talks about Bilal, this black man who converted to Islam, and he was held as a slave by a slave master, and that Muhammad had him set free precisely because he was impressed by Bilal's faith. The slave owner of Bilal was torturing him, wanted to get him to give up his faith in Islam, had a rock put on his chest, and Bilal had to hold it up, but he still would not renounce his faith. And then Muhammad was so impressed by this man's faith that he had him set free. This actually parallels an emphasis in Islam on being Muslim and not being enslaved, that you could not enslave Muslims according to Islamic doctrine. You can, however, enslave non-Muslims. And as Raymond Ibrahim has noted in his book, Sword and Scimitar, acquiring non-Muslim slaves was precisely a key incentive to engage in jihad, to conquer other people, to conquer these non-Muslims. You could then have them as slaves. John Azuma has noted that many of the slaves bought by European slavers in Africa were first enslaved by Muslim slavers who enslaved these non-Muslim Africans, and then they sold them to these Europeans. So you had Africans enslaved first on the basis of religion. They were non-Muslims. And then they were sold to European slave traders on the basis of race. They were black. So these two groups of slavers, Muslim slavers and European white American slavers or slavers in the New World, working sort of hand in hand to enslave black Africans for different reasons with different justifications. So there's a big distinction in Islam between whether you're Muslim or not and whether therefore you can be enslaved. This is, of course, has absolutely nothing to do with the abolition movement in the United States and around the world that was led by Christians, where the religion of someone didn't matter. It didn't matter what religion black slaves in the American South had, according to Abraham Lincoln or other abolitionists. They just simply thought that slavery was immoral. Consendini then, so he focuses on Islam as being the sort of anti-racist faith, and then he focuses on precisely what is called Muhammad's farewell sermon before he died in 632, where he talked about there's no difference between an Arab and a non-Arab, and a white man has no superiority over a black man, but that people are only distinguished by piety and actions. And so Craig Consendini says that this is supposedly a revolutionary development in world race relations, that this is somehow the first time that anyone pronounced human equality across all ethnicities. So a lot of problems with this view here. For one thing, it ignores, again, the Bible that came before Muhammad. In the Bible, in the Jewish scriptures, particularly, humanity is made in the image of God. All people are made in the image of God. And as I noted particularly before, the condemnations of enslavement enslavers in both the Jewish and the Christian scriptures. Exodus chapter 21, verse 16, says actually that there's a death penalty for anyone who who enslaves people, and that then combined with the scriptures such as, say, Deuteronomy, that Jews are supposed to treat foreigners as equal. You're supposed to treat a foreigner as you would treat yourself. Means that that's then a general prohibition on slavery, and any other references to slavery in the Jewish scriptures are merely to things like, say, servitude of, say, conquered peoples under the Jews as a form of divine punishment, or say forms of indentured servitude or so forth. But there's no actual acceptance of slavery in the Jewish scriptures, or for that matter, in the Christian scriptures. Where in the first epistle of Timothy, there's once again condemnation of slavers alongside, say, sexually immoral people, prostitutes and homosexuals. And you also have the letter to Philemon, where the Apostle Paul asked for a slave owner to treat his escaped slave who is with Paul, come to Paul, the same way he would treat Paul as a brother. So once again, which would mean that he should free this slave so that we should all be brothers with one another. This completely contrasts with, for example, this Muslim convert, Jonathan Brown, who's a professor at Georgetown University, leads their Saudi-established Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, who about 5 years ago had this scandalous episode where he actually said that because Muhammad himself is clearly documented as having owned slaves, and according to Islamic doctrine, he's this perfect example, this perfect man, and we're supposed to all try to emulate Muhammad, then you cannot simply a priori say that slavery is wrong. He also justified sex slavery, saying that historically consent for sex hasn't been such a big issue. After all, you had, say, arranged marriages in Victorian England or something, which somehow justified jihad rape. It's really astonishing that Constantini would try to hold up Islam as some sort of anti-racist, anti-slavery faith. Aside from the fact that Constantini, whatever Islam says about racial equality, I mean, even if you say that Islam in principle is against racism, just like, say, communism or Christianity or other ideological beliefs, that simply ignores the issues of Islam's discrimination, various discriminations against non-Muslims or women, I mean, particularly Christians and Jews under the Fimi system, where they were this subjugated population that had all these often been, as they're called, second-class citizens or even worse, and have to wear distinguishing clothing, and they have to pay this poll tax. And the question then arises is, why is any such religious apartheid better than racial apartheid? Constantini, for example, likes to focus on Malcolm X and how he had this racial epiphany on the Hajj, his Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, before he was killed in 1965, about a year before, I believe, where Malcolm X had been a member of this Nation of Islam and had really developed this hatred of whites. But then when he went on the pilgrimage to Mecca, he saw all these people from around the world, all these Muslims from around the world, of just all different backgrounds. I mean, white skin, black skin, brown skin, blue-eyed. And then he just thought, well, look, if we're all Muslims, you just can't be racist. Well, that's as good as far as it goes, but it doesn't deal with any of the fundamental human rights issues in Islam, precisely in a country like Saudi Arabia, where Malcolm X was. I mean, this is a society which, until relatively recently, did not allow women to drive, and they have to wear a veil, and blasphemers of Islam can be whipped or beheaded. You have brutal human rights abuses. There can be no religion in Saudi Arabia other than Islam. You can't have a church or a synagogue. Its schools educate people with just the worst of jihadist hatred of Jews and Christians, and that then gives rise to jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda, the Islamic doctrines historically that non-Muslims really should not be in the Arabian Peninsula. So when you had all these non-Muslim American troops in the Arabian Peninsula, that was seen by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as a reason to go to war with the United States, to then attack the United States on September 11, 2001, destroy the World Trade Center. So I'm not really sure why we should celebrate Islam simply because in doctrine it does not necessarily advocate racism. That still didn't help anyone on September 11, 2001. Or for that matter, if you think of Christians in Egypt and Pakistan that are treated, these Christian minorities that are treated as dirty, according to Quran, Surah 9, Chapter 9, Ayah, verse 28, there Christians in Egypt and Pakistan face heavy discrimination and such that they're forced into really dirty jobs, like the Christians in Egypt are known for being trash collectors, and Christians in Pakistan, as recently reported by a New York Times story, they're often engaged in cleaning sewers and so forth, but Muslim businesses don't want to have them, say, working in hotels, cleaning things and so forth, because they're just simply considered as non-Muslims, dirty, and they're so that you don't want them dirtying dishes or beds or anything like that. I'm not sure why Craig Constantini's praise for non-racism in Islam should make us overlook that. Constantini in particular, he praises Islam, but this goes along with his hatred of Israel. He's also tweeted out online on several occasions that Israel is engaged in crimes against humanity of apartheid and ethnic cleansing and colonialism. So here again, Constantine is certainly doing nothing to criticize long-standing doctrines of anti-Semitism deeply embedded within Islamic canons like the Quran and these Hadith narratives of Muhammad. If you think about, for example, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, there under the rules administered by the Islamic religious authorities that the Israelis have left in place on the Temple Mount. Jews are not allowed to pray on the Temple Mount, even though Muslims can pray on the Temple Mount, and indeed Muslims can just simply go out to the Temple Mount and kind of hang out there, and families will go there and kids will, say, play with balls and so forth, but access of non-Muslims to the Temple Mount is highly restricted for Jews and Christians. Once again, Jews have been seen as dirty, according to these doctrines of Islamic anti-Semitism. Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of president of the Palestinian Authority, has referred to dirty Jews, Jews with their dirty feet, desecrating the Temple Mount if they should go up there. Constantini seems to be painting an image of Islam being non-racist, and yet he's simply going along with or promoting Islamic hatred of Israel and Jews, of this Jewish state of Israel. This also parallels his great hero, Malcolm X, who is noted for his anti-Semitism and his hatred of Israel. His autobiography is known for being promoting a lot of anti-Semitism in his speeches. You can find, for example, online, he engages in a lot of rants against Jews. And in 1964, he was interviewed by an Egyptian newspaper and talked about how the evils of Zionism, and for example, he wrote that the number one weapon of stated that the number one weapon of 20th century imperialism is Zionist dollarism. There's a key contrast then here between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King with respect to the civil rights movement. Constantini always he says that we should really follow Muhammad. He says, look, I'm not a Muslim. He comes from a Catholic background, but he praises Muhammad as someone to follow. This gives at least a kind of has a kind of indirect proselytization effect, inciting people to become Muslim because supposedly Muhammad was a great anti-racist. This has a certain American history. If you think of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in Islam and Christianity, Martin Luther King wrote precisely in his famous 1965 letter from a Birmingham jail where he talked about, he justified the whole doctrine of civil disobedience, that you disobey wrong positive laws like racial segregation in the name of a higher natural moral law. And in particular, there's a line in there where he says, because of the poor Christian witness of various white Christian churches, that they took a rather lukewarm approach to the civil rights movement. They advocated that African Americans sort of not press the issue of civil rights, be kind of go slow on the issue. That many blacks, disgusted by this kind of acquiescence in racism, actually gave up on Christianity, gave up on Christ. They abandoned their salvation. And although Martin Luther King does not specifically reference Islam, I mean, that's clearly the faith he's indicating, that they gave up on Christ and that they went to Islam or to groups like the Nation of Islam, like Malcolm X. So Martin Luther King, this noted Christian leader who led the civil rights movement, he was, unlike Craig Considine, he was not such a big fan of everyone admiring Muhammad or becoming a Muslim. I mean, he actually worried about people abandoning Christ for this Arabian prophet, Muhammad. And again, it should be noted that it was precisely Christians who led the fight against slavery and then for civil rights, as well as, for example, considering Considine and Malcolm X hatred for Jews in Israel. Jews, of course, played an enormous role in supporting the civil rights movement and the NAACP. It's very strange that, though, that Craig Considine sort of indicates that we should all look to Muhammad and Islam as some sort of source of civil rights, but while ignoring the entire abolitionist movement among Christians and then later for civil rights. The United States, after all, in the Civil War, was the only country that actually fought a war whose central issue was slavery, a war ultimately that abolished slavery. No Muslim society has ever done that. Slavery took a long time to die out within the majority of Muslim societies. It was not until 1963, indeed, that Saudi Arabia officially abolished slavery, and now it still exists undercover in places like Mauritania. Well, I think, to conclude here, any condemnation of slavery and racism must have a global perspective. If we're going to look at these evils in the United States, in our own history, and in European history, we have to understand how they're part and parcel of wider phenomena. The West did not invent slavery, something which has existed throughout history in any society you can think of. I mean, Native American societies, for example, the Aztecs, of course, were slave societies and engaged in human sacrifice as well, something which was then destroyed precisely by their subjugation and the colonization, the development of the New World and these new societies in Mexico, and the overthrow of the various Native American civilizations like the Aztecs and so forth, and the process that created our what we know as modern Latinos, this Christian Western-based society with mixed-race populations. But to not engage in such a global perspective and to see how slavery and prejudices like racism, or for that matter, against Jews or Christians and all sorts of prejudices have existed around the world and throughout history. And indeed, it's really precisely this Judeo-Christian West that has given rise to what Thomas Sowell, this black conservative commentator, has noted is what is truly exceptional, truly unique, namely a society that abolishes slavery, that believes in individual human dignity, a society of freedom. That is what is truly exceptional across the sweep of human history. Slavery and bigotry and all sorts of other evils are actually rather normal in human history. What's exceptional is precisely the kind of society that we have in the United States. And the United States, with its American Revolution beginning in 1776, led the way in creating this free world. This is truly then the society where black lives and other lives, Jewish lives, matter, not really other societies, really not Muslim-majority societies in the Islamic Republic of Iran or Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, Afghanistan or Sudan or Turkey, Syria, Libya. So without this proper perspective, such reflection upon condemnation of such evils in the United States and in the West in general, slavery and racism, it can just degenerate into just an anti-Western hatred, anti-Western cant, from which, of course, other ideologies will benefit, leftists or Islamists. Communists, for example, throughout the Cold War and up to today, have always claimed that racism and slavery, that these were the simply the results of capitalism. And in order to eliminate this, you had to eliminate capitalism, and we had to become socialists, join with the Soviet Union, even though, of course, this Soviet empire had its own prejudices, its own colonialism, its own imperialism, its own racism. And Islam, of course, has its own, has grown around the world through imperialist conquest, through jihad, and the interlinkage of that with slavery. So it's important to keep that global perspective, and if leftists or Islamists are going to try to exploit these past, the involvement of the West in these past sins, these evils, then they should be called to account, and they should be forced to look into a mirror and say, well, look, what are you doing about your involvement, your past legacy in these evils? It's hypocritical for you to throw such stones from your massive glass house. And we have to really treasure the freedom of the West and expand upon that and strengthen that around the world, which means critically examining these other ideologies among the left and in Islam to truly advance human freedom. Well, I'll leave you with those thoughts today, this week, on this Friday, and I hope you'll tune in next Friday for yet another episode of Islam in Focus with me, your show host, Andrew E. Harrod, and where we will discuss the role of Islam in the world for both Muslims and non-Muslims. And I'll look forward to talking to you then again. Until then, bye.